turned out that I wasn't teaching the class, and the class that I was teaching in the communication design department was very instrumental in me sort of thinking, well, we should do some public affairs interview programs. And then my idea was, I knew Sue was a great interviewer and she's smart as a whip. Mm-hmm. And not hard to work with usually. And
no, he'll pay for that.
So anyway,
no, I know what he means. I know exactly what he means.
We didn't have that thing going with the class, but we wanted to do something anyway. And so Sue came up with the idea, and I'm not the idea guy. I like to help people realize their vision. It's been part of my professional makeup for as long as I've been in media. And so it seemed great. And I actually knew some people who were filmmakers in the community, and we had some meetings, and take it from there, Sue.
Holy cow, what a long, crazy trip. I don't know how it happened, to be perfectly honest. I don't know how it happened. In the beginning, I saw Dan at the Sierra Nevada Brewery one night at the Big Room.
I never go there.
Yeah, I know. And so I think we had each had a couple of beers, and he said, hey, I teach this class. Any way you'd want to do your radio show in front of the television cameras? And I was like, sure, how hard could that be? And that was a really interesting journey to realize that television is not nearly, it's not similar to radio at all. And so
there's an awful lot of pictures.
So we did it. We jumped in. We learned a ton of stuff. Man, we learned so much. So as Dan said, we decided to do this gun thing. And it was so interesting because all of a sudden, people started to join in. Mm-hmm. And it just, every day I would wake up and I would say, we have one more person that's very skilled, very talented, very reputable, that has decided to participate with this project. And every once in a while, I think there's no turning back now because there's too many people that have committed.
Invested, yeah.
Yeah, it's, and not even financially, just people that are very talented and very knowledgeable and very loving and very concerned and committed about the topic, and it's like all of a sudden it was like the path opened up before us, and it's just been an amazing ride.
So my guests tonight are Syl Hildebrand and Dan Carter, and they are doing an incredible series of films about guns, and I do hope that it gets off the ground because this is such an important issue. And on the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence blog, they say, the point is not to justify a particular side of the debate, but to allow us to humanize the other so we can approach the debate more productively. And I just think that is such a wise statement. And because to me, it's like, Israel and Palestine. I have very strong opinions. I have very strong thoughts about gun violence and what needs to be done about it. But to just take this eye that you're bringing to it to humanize both sides. Can you talk about that?
It's sort of Dan and I both come from a perspective of, you know, gun control. And as we explored this topic and really started to talk with a lot of people that are not gun control folks, they're pro guns, pro Second Amendment, it became really clear that it's not so black and white. Gun violence, we can all agree, is bad and we need to reduce it. But what we've learned along the way is people connect with a gun. It's an emotional connection. You know, you hear a lot, well, it's just a tool. But the truth is, it's not a tool. We have an emotional connection or revulsion to a gun. And it's interesting, as we've talked with very conservative folks, what we've learned is a gun and gun culture represents a political identity. And for people that are in that culture and feel an identity to that world, for somebody to say, we need more gun control and background checks, what you're essentially doing is saying, we don't trust you. We don't trust your people. We don't believe you. We are questioning who you are and your family and your neighbors and all that stuff. And I'm not saying that we should have more guns. I'm certainly not saying that. But to approach a conversation where somebody feels attacked, we never have a conversation. We have an argument, and then we end up stop talking to each other. And the reality is, where we've gone in the last, since the Heller decision, D.C. versus Heller, that where Antonin Scalia said that, yes, the Second Amendment includes the right to self-defense. That was a watershed moment for the gun rights movement. Since that time, and really since, you know, the late 70s, the pro-gun rights folks are winning. And the idea is there's little incentive for them to engage. And so if you're winning, why engage? And so what I think part of this film is to do is to say, this is why people won't engage with the left. This is why people won't engage with the right. And so it's this idea of the gun debate is about fear. People have guns because they're afraid. People want to get rid of guns because they're afraid. But the gun debate is not about fear. It's about my right or mental health. It's not about the real issues. And so we're trying to uncover, we're trying to push aside some of the superficial arguments that get us no further in having true dialogue on how we reduce gun violence.
One of the things I like about what you two are doing is that you're not just going with your own opinions or even that very wise statement that you just made. You have a panel of advisors. Can you tell us about your advisors and how you got them?
Go ahead.
It's like, I can't believe these people signed on. We have an advisory board of 7 scholars. I mean, one of our advisors, Dr. Saul Cornell out of Fordham University, has been quoted by the Supreme Court. And these folks, one day, you know, Dan and I were saying, okay, let's do a film on guns. And it was really just a matter of following our curiosity and saying, okay, the gun debate is not satisfying. The arguments are not satisfying. And instead, what's really going on? Oh, it's about fear. Oh, it's about political identity. It's about depression. It's about economics. It's all of those things. So we just started gathering people, inviting people, and they said yes. So we had a bunch of people, our team, and all of these scholars. We flew them in to Sacramento in January, and we sat around a table for the entire day. We came up with a mission statement. We had a real very fascinating discussion. We have 2 historians, we have 3 sociologists, a psychologist, and a philosopher. And those folks all come at the issue of guns and gun violence from different perspectives. And we had just a fascinating meeting. And it was so exhilarating for people. And we just basically after that said, hey, you want to be on our advisory board? And now they're working with us and they're promoting it. And I call them regularly and say, you know, I got this crazy idea. What do you think? And they answer the phone when I call. It's just amazing to me. And they're very patient, and they give us, you know, all of the guidance that we need. These are the experts in the field. It's just, it's a gift that we find ourselves in this place.
Yeah, and then just to say something that, more in support of Sue is she's been laying the foundation for doing something like that for a long, long time, doing her radio show. And so it was through that she has developed the connections and the acquaintances and the people she can call to talk to in order that we could build an advisory board of such high caliber individuals. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, things like this don't just happen overnight. It isn't a matter of just picking up a phone. Really, the road work, the roadbed has been laid over the years.
And to throw in Dan's 30-odd years of doing this work, it's so serendipity. It's so serendipitous, this work that we're doing. Suddenly we're almost in the eye of the storm. Mm. It's fascinating.
It really is. Yeah. It really is. We were in Austin last week, and Texas is a great place to go to talk to people about guns. that was the first thing that I figured out. And I had the pleasure of having my son along as a production assistant. And one very positive aspect of that for me was my son Dylan is, he's a pretty open-minded kid. He's has very similar liberal sensibilities as his father, but he was like a funnel in the right position. He was just drinking it up, all of the interviews that we did, all the different points of view and everything, and he was doing great. But the thing about Austin was that, like I said, it's a great place to go to talk about guns. And at University of Texas at Austin, we interviewed people on both sides and kind of neutral in a way of the issue of them having a concealed carry in classrooms starting in August. And that was just really, from a California sensibility, a lot of that stuff is not, it's like we
mind boggled.
People leave this state because they won't let them do that. And that's just the thing. So we get to go and hear people's really frank and honest discussions, and they make everybody has their point to make, so part of the purpose of doing this is that we want the voices to be heard. We want all the voices to be heard.
Well, it reminds me of when my brother and I were little and we had our Davy Crockett outfits and we had our little open carry then too, but they were real. Kind of scary there, Dan. My name is Chris and I'm filling in tonight on Views and Beyond. I'm in the studio with Dan Carter, who is an incredible videographer, and Sue Hildebrand, who you probably know from The Real Issue. It airs every Wednesday night at 6 o'clock here on KZFR. And we were talking about a film that they are currently making. It's called One Nation Under the Gun. And I really hope that our audience is going to be able to help them make this film. But let's talk a little more first about what you're trying to do. Your advisor said after you talked to them, you had basic themes. And it was that the views of Americans are more nuanced than what the media suggest. The current debate is based on statistics which don't address and cannot change the emotional aspect of guns. And many of the voices of everyday Americans are currently left out of the debate. I'd like to know about those everyday Americans. What is your sense about what America is thinking or feeling about the gun, quote-unquote, debate?
That's a big question. It's all over the road. It's all over the road. I think the sense that I get of what we're trying to do is that we're trying to make it so that the people on one side yelling at people at the other side is less, and the people in the middle who are interested in hearing facts and getting perspectives, so that they have something that they can hold on to in this film, so that this film will bring them something that is going to help the gun debate make sense to them, and. And Sue, maybe you have something to add to that.
In terms of, Chris, you asked about, what are the idea of the debate is more nuanced than what's portrayed in the media. And what I have been noticing, and I think Dan is sort of with me on this, is it's very rare that I talk to everybody. I mean, random people on the street I talk to about guns. And I very rarely hear anybody say, let's get rid of guns. Rarely do I hear that. There's always this, because there's this identity, American identity with guns. And so I think often we Americans will say, well, I don't like all those guns and gun violence, but I don't think we should get rid of all of them. And so I almost never hear people say, let's get rid of guns. And I almost never hear people say we should have anything we want. And when we think about the gun debate, when we listen to it, we talk about the NRA that says we need to have all the guns we want, and this is our constitutional right, and it ensures that we don't have tyranny. But then we have other sides that say, actually, I think the left wing is getting savvy in terms of the language. But even the right wing will portray the left wing as we need to get rid. Those people over there want to get rid of guns, and it really is more nuanced. I have pinned people down very conservative rhetoric and said things like, "So would you support any gun control? No way. Do you think that we should have required training and background checks? Well, yeah, that's fine. So." You do support gun control, but we've so divided the issue as if you're not in one camp or the other camp, you don't exist. And the debate is more nuanced, and that's what we're trying to do. And so we interviewed a couple guys from the Huey P. Newton Gun Club out of Dallas, and here are these very radical African Americans that talked about, look, we live in a very racist society and our communities are being targeted by the police. Yeah, we want to have guns to protect ourselves. And the beauty of those men, you know, the photos that we got, they're very scary looking with their shotguns and their camo and the whole thing. But they were the sweetest men in the world, and they would give me this interview. We have it all on camera, and they would be so passionate and grumpy and angry and demanding, and I wouldn't say anything because I didn't want to interrupt, and I would just watch them. And at the end of their passion and anger, they would give me the sweetest, biggest, goofiest smile, and you realize these are just scared little boys, just like all the rest of us. And so it's hard for me to argue with this person and say, they're there, just give away your gun to us. You know, and so it's like we're bringing in those voices. I'm certainly not saying let's give shotguns to everybody. I'm not saying that at all. But if we start talking about why are these people arming themselves, then we realize that if we want to get rid of guns in everyday society, we have to deal with racism, really seriously deal with racism. We have to seriously deal with why are we people that are privileged, why are we tolerant of devastated communities and inner cities that have very little economic and educational opportunities? That's what causes gun violence, not the gun per se. So if we as a community recognize why people are picking up guns and shooting each other, the goal is different. It's not necessarily to get rid of the gun. It's to get rid of why somebody would pick it up and shoot themselves or shoot somebody else.
Yeah, and that was going to be my next question, but you sort of answered it about the larger political social context in America, but that was good, and I'm glad you did. The other thing that I think is important is you make a point of talking about when guns are used, that the largest source of gun-related deaths is suicide, and the next largest source is inner-city violence, in which the people that are harmed are poor, mostly black communities. So is part of your quest to understand these factors too? It's a deeper, big issue.
It is. They're huge issues, and that's the larger economic and social and even political context. And we'll do a piece on that that will kind of provide the backdrop for a lot of the film. And so, again, this is some of the reasons is that I think that we have this strange, superficial debate. Some people say we want more guns. Some people say we want less guns because of all of this gun violence and school shootings and terrorism and all of that stuff. But what most people don't know, and you just mentioned it, Chris, is if we just to use easy numbers, 30,000 Americans are killed by guns every year. Two-thirds, so 20,000 of those are self-inflicted, and it's mostly white men in rural areas. And so if we really want to address gun violence and gun death, we have to ask ourselves, why are white rural men killing themselves? And there's a lot of reasons. Untreated mental illness, untreated PTSD, loss of economic opportunity. You used to be able in this country to graduate from high school, or not even graduate from high school, get a decent paying job, take care of your family, and have a happy little life. You can't do that anymore because of, and this gets really wacky, is because of the results of neoliberal policies where we have commodified everything, and we've seen the exportation of so many working class jobs. So one of the people that we're going to interview when we go to New York in a couple weeks is we're actually going to interview one of the co-authors of that major study out of Princeton who she and her husband identified that there's a demographic between 45 and 55 of mostly men, but white people with low education, high school and below, are killing themselves, either suicide or what they say poisoning, which is alcohol and drug abuse, killing themselves at such a high rate that it is increasing the mortality rate of that group of people. And so we're going to interview one of these, one of the authors of this study. And what she argues is, as an economist, she argues that it is the reason so many suicides, that it's increasing the mortality rate of an entire demographic. She says it's because of the loss of economic opportunity. And so if we want to deal with gun violence, we have to deal with suicide. If we want to deal with suicide, we have to seriously think about why are people doing this? Economic opportunity is lost and mental health facilities are not available. So that's two-thirds. At that last 10,000, 60% or 6,000 is black-on-black violence in very concentrated areas of the inner city. And why do they do that? No economic opportunity, no education. So taking away guns, that's a fight I don't think we're going to win. So if we want to deal with gun violence, we've got to think a bit more creatively.
Another thing that your documentary is going to work on is the mythology or the false history about guns and kind of the marketing strategy to men. Can you talk a little bit about that? Maybe you, Dan, since you're a man. I mean, you understand it better than I do.
Well, I'm not the person who's been studying this, but from what I've heard, what was it, around the turn of the century, the Winchester, was it?
Repeating Arms Company.
The Winchester Repeating Arms Company saw that they weren't selling as many guns. And so they began engaging in what was then a very new form of communication called advertising. And very subtly at times and not so subtly at other times, encouraging people who didn't need guns that they did need guns. people who didn't need a gun because they lived on a ranch and needed that kind of protection. So they got them through advertising and persuasion to believe that they needed guns. And so that's sort of started things off, and then popular culture, motion pictures in the early days, and you know, the whole idea of good guys and bad guys, and the way that guns are portrayed in, you know, you can solve any problem you have in the Old West if you have a gun and you're a good shot.
That's right.
And so that has been coming along ever since then, and so I think what we're trying to do is to we have one of our advisory board members has written a great book, and help me, Sue, the name of the book is The Gunning of America.
Pamela Haig.
It's
coming out next month. It's gotten great reviews, and this woman is on our advisory board because she believes in the project.
Yeah, and so it's going to be really interesting to approach that entire issue from that point of view of the reason that you believe that you need a gun doesn't have to do with the fact that your granddad had a gun. It has to do with the fact that your granddad was convinced he needed a gun, and then it just goes down through
it's a family thing.
Families.
Right.
Exactly, and which is a very fascinating piece that we are going to weave into this. When we go to New York, we have another guy, he's a folklorist. Mm. And so what Dan was saying, just to kind of bring that one up to speed, is part of the mythology is we as Americans, we believe we need a gun. That's what fought off the British, and that's how we won the West. The truth is, most folks didn't have guns. We didn't have gunsmiths here in this country. So your gun broke, and that was the end of that. You didn't have a gun anymore. And so when the Winchester Repeating Arms Company, they figured out, here is an object, here is a tool. How do we, and people don't need this anymore. They're moving to the cities. They don't need a gun so much. And so they created that emotional connection. And so a folklorist that we're going to interview talks about the need for story, the need for narrative, the need for tradition. And he says that's how a society is stable, is we tell our stories and we know where we are in the bigger picture. I am Sue, and I am the daughter of Denise, and I am the sister of Ginny, and Dan is, so I know where I fit in the world, and I know what the world, the structure of my world, and I know how to behave. Well, as our society has changed, right, we've seen the loss of jobs, and we've seen the rise of women, and we've seen the demand for equality from African Americans, and, you know, and things are changing, and our stories are breaking down, and the old mythology, the false history is, well, I got my gun.
And I'm going to...
Those are the stories. And a real man takes care of himself. And a real man has a gun. So part of this film is sort of to point out that that's not our history.
Right.
And what's not told is there's always been, Chris, you know this, there's always been the pacifist, the anti-war, the non-violent voice in our history. We've always had it. It's just, they didn't have as good of a marketing firm as the Winchester Repeating Arms Company.
That's for sure. You know, before we run out of time, the most important thing I wanted to do with you guys tonight is to ask you how people in our listening audience can support your project.
Well, we have a Kickstarter campaign that is currently underway. And is the easiest way to just Google Kickstarter One Nation Under the Gun?
Just go to Kickstarter.com, and when you look for, you know, there's a search engine in Kickstarter.com, and you just write One Nation Under the Gun, and there's our trailer. Dan and his people, his video gurus, they created an amazing trailer, so you can actually watch the trailer for this film, get a sense of what this film is about, what we're trying to accomplish, and right there, you can contribute. Any amount is helpful.
Yes. Yeah, our goal is $70,000, and we're feeling pretty good about it, but we really do need more people to contribute, and we could use about $525 donors, actually.
That's right. $525 donors. You can be one of those folks. Yeah. It's, you know, even if you just see the trailer and support us in your heart and your mind, or give us a call or send us an email, that's appreciated too.
Yes.
But the film gets made with the cash, so it'd be great.
Yep. Yeah.
One Nation Under the Gun.
One Nation Under the Gun. And I hope that our listeners will find out about it right away and give generously, because Kickstarter is merciless. You either get the money or you don't. And
well, here's the thing that a lot of people don't know is that you make a credit card contribution, and if we don't make the goal, then your credit card is never charged for your contribution. So your money doesn't go down a rabbit hole and end up with, you know, me and Sue in the Bahamas. No, that doesn't happen.
But it does sound enticing, doesn't it?
No, but you can make a contribution. They don't take it out of your credit card until after the Kickstarter campaign is successful. But we really, truly do need your support. We need our listening audience to, you know, take this very seriously, because we're dedicated to this. We've invested a tremendous amount of our personal
fortune.
Your fortune.
Yeah, I always hesitate to call money I borrow as fortune.
It is, yeah. Well. It's been a labor of love so far.
Yes,
and
indeed.
We really believe
an expensive
in it.
Labor of love.
Yeah. We really believe in it. Our real serious goal is to produce a film that will not pick a side per se, but will push the conversation forward.
It's going to be amazing. And Sue Hildebrand and Dan Carter, I wish you the very best, and I'll keep trying to give you money. But I would like to do something unusual at this point. I would like Dan to do the interviewing because we have another guest coming on, okay. And you're going to be doing the interview.
I am. I'm going to put on different headphones and another hat.
All right. So
and,
I'll just
Bill DeBlanc's coming in, and I just want to say that Bill is helping us out because he's loaned me one of his cameras to take that we took to Austin.
So Bill is part of the team.
Bill is part of the team. Okay, I'm keeping talking. If be nice if we had some. Oh, okay. Bill's going to sit over there.
Well, no, I was going to put on some music. On.
Oh, put some. Bill's going to put some music on. Hey, Chris Nelson, thank you very, very much. We really appreciate it. Thanks for giving us a chance. All right, you're in tune to FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio from the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And the next guest on Butte Views and Beyond is going to be Bill DeBlanc. And Bill's about ready to play some music that he has recorded. Or is that already playing? No, it isn't. I'd hear it in the headphones. So, yeah, take off, Bill, any old time. Yeah, that's Hannah Jane Kyle
Yeah, that was recorded just a few weeks ago at the Chico Women's Club. That was the KZFR benefit.
That's
where
right.
Where Hannah Jane Kyle opened for Joe Craven and the Sumtimers. That was a really
fun
show.
It was a really fun show, and we were there videotaping.
Right.
And actually, this
audio
was...
audio taping as well.
Yeah. And it... it was one of those deals where the class that I teach, the students, and we brought our equipment over, and we did a four camera, actually turned into five or six cameras recording of it. And Bill, what do you plan to do with all that stuff?
Well, that song from that show, along with a song from the Joe Craven performance, are going to be, assuming Joe Craven approves his song, are going to be in an upcoming episode of this television show I'm producing, which airs on Channel 9. Mm-hmm. The show is called The Banana Grape Stomp, and it's on Saturday nights at 10 o'clock on KIXE Channel 9. That's the local public, you know, PBS station here in the Chico Redding market. They're out of Redding, and over the air, if you got a good antenna, you can pick it up in Chico, or you can also get it on your cable or satellites.
On your local cable.
Yeah.
And you also put them online.
Put them online. I've been putting them online after they premiere on Saturday. I generally on Monday is the day I kind mm-hmm. of make
are
them
available.
Are
they just hanging out there on YouTube? Is that what generally happens?
Yes. Okay. And there's six episodes that have aired so far. The first, the premiere was on January 2nd. Six have been on so far, and you can check all those out.
Okay. Can you give us, our listeners who are unfamiliar.
Yeah, definitely.
Can you give us a sense of what kind of artists
exactly
and what kind
of
venues?
Yeah. yeah, The Banana Grape Stomp is a music performance type television show. It's a half hour long, and it's the way that I structure it is each show is featuring a different venue or benefit concert or multi-band festival. And so the episodes will have usually four or five different groups that the first episode, for instance, was from the Sierra Nevada Big Room. And so there was, you know, four performances from that. And then the second one was from the For the Funk of It Festival. So there was a few different bands playing at that. And eventually I'm going to have some episodes as well that feature a different or one particular artist, and we'll most likely have the artist playing at several different places.
Nice.
But so I've been pretty busy for the last couple years with the help of Dan, a lot of help from Dan, a ton of help from Dan, and as well as a few other people. Kyle Porter has helped out a lot with audio recording and some video as well. And
let's not forget Molly Knight.
Molly, definitely don't forget. We can't forget Molly.
The lovely and talented Molly Knight.
Yes. Molly is the host of the show. I should definitely mention Molly. And she introduces the clips of the bands, and each show has a kind of a guest co-host. And like, for instance, from the Big Room, it was Bob Littell who
right.
came on there and talked about, you know, a little about the Sierra Nevada Brewery and the Big Room and what they try to bring in the music, you know, there. And then, you know, from... DJ Spenny was on from the For the Funk of It Festival and things like that. So what I'm trying to do is trying to get the word out, trying to help, you know, about the different events and venues around, you know, that happen around Northern California, as well as the bands and stuff. And yeah, and you know, Molly's been a great host. You know, she's just somebody that I knew that I thought might be good at it. And I asked her, and she was like, "Oh yeah, well I'll give that a try." And so far, it's worked out great, I think.
Yeah, she's got a lot of charisma. She's
definitely
very charming.
Definitely.
Very charming. Bill, how did this idea come about? What the hell happened?
Well, basically, I mean, I've been like recording music and shooting video of music for a long time, but. It really kind of started, I mean, one day, I don't know, 6 years ago or something, I was over at Kyle's house, at Kyle Porter's house, and we were watching Channel 9, and the show came on. I can't remember the exact title, but it was something like Live from Hippie Jacks or something like that. And it was basically some guy, I don't know, had a big backyard and put on music events there and you know, shot some video of it. And Kyle said, "Your stuff is better than this. Why don't you make a show?" And so, I mean, it took me, you know, from that day about 5 years or something before it actually made it on the air. But
you had a lot of experience doing audio recordings and video recordings. You have stuff from the Mother Hips that you did, what, in the 80s?
Well, no, they weren't going in the 80s.
Oh, sorry.
But no, I...
How long ago did you start shooting video?
Well, I really started in 1999. I mean, I shot a little bit before that, but 1999 is kind of when I really kind of stepped.
Well, 15 years is no small chunk of time.
but I made a movie about the Mother Hips called This Is the Sound, and I kind of describe it as a Kids Are All Right style documentary, kind of collecting all just, different footage from a lot of stuff that I didn't shoot. In fact, the original idea from it was that I was just going to put it all together from all different stuff I could find. But it turned out that while I was working on it, I was shooting stuff too, and it ended up being about half and half, you know. Mm-hmm. Half of it was old stuff with Mike, their original drummer. And that I had collected from other people that had shot it, and about half of it was new stuff that I shot myself.
Was the Mother Hips movie before or after the one that you did about High Sierra?
That was before.
Okay.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, and the Mother Hips movie came out about in 2004. It came out while they took a little hiatus that lasted about a year and a half. Or actually, it came out right about the time they ended their hiatus.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, when I was finishing it up, they were actually taking a little break. And so, and it was good timing because that was before there was YouTube, you know. It was really hard to see video of Mother Hips when I was working on that movie. I mean, there was a couple really low quality videos you could watch on the internet at that time, but there was no YouTube at the time and no files, you know. So unless you had like a VHS tape or a DVD-R or something, hardly anybody even had those yet, you know. And so anyway, when the movie came out, people were really anxious for it. It's kind of different. If I was to make that same movie now, everybody would be like, oh, I could just go watch 10,000 different, you know, videos of Mother Hips on the internet. But
that's not what makes a movie. I mean, which brings
right.
me to, you know, you are a filmmaker and as such, the first thing I want to say is something that attracted me to Bill's project is I've seen his work, and he amazed me the way he could shoot an event, shoot a musical group with one camera, and then when it comes out in the editing, it's like you'd swear that there were three cameras there. And this isn't an easy thing to do. If anybody out there is familiar with this sort of a task, an editing task, but Bill's like got it down to a science, as near as I can tell.
Well, luckily, because of your help and other people's help, I don't have to do that as much anymore. but that just kind of came out of necessity, you know.
Yeah,
and just trying to, you know, because when I first started, when I first got a camera, I was kind of thinking about just building an archive and maybe someday licensing footage to documentaries, you know. And so I would make sure that I got lots of different shots, you know, not just one shot of the whole bandstand or whatever, but I'd get lots of close-ups of the different band members and shots of the crowd and the whole scene and stuff like that. And so that's, you know, kind of what I've been doing. And that's kind of that High Sierra movie that you mentioned. That's kind of what I put that together with, because that most of that, when I recorded all that stuff over a course of a lot of years, it was just stuff that I recorded, you know, for my own personal, you know, archive or whatever. And then when the festival was, you know, coming up to 20 years old, I was like, okay, well, I should do something with it and, you know, take the best of it and put it all together. And, you know, and that's what I did. And that's actually a totally unofficial, you know, it's project. It's like unsanctioned or whatever. But luckily, nobody's gotten mad at me or whatever about it. But you can go. It's called High Sierra Memories, and you can watch that on YouTube.
Right on. So what were your influences to become a person that makes movies or videos about music?
Well, I think the first thing that really kind of inspired me was the movie Gimme Shelter, with the movie with the Rolling Stones, mm-hmm. that has so much footage of that there, you know, the show at Altamont.
Do you remember who made that movie? Was it?
Oh, the Maisels Brothers.
Okay.
Yeah. And Yeah, they when I was a sophomore in high school, they played that on Channel 40. And so that just kind of – so I watched that. And I just – even though that's – in some ways, that's a really kind of difficult movie to watch because what happens in it with the guy getting, you know, stabbed and stuff. But I was just I was just so fascinated by the footage of just the people hanging around at Altamont, you know, and the footage of the, you know, the Flying Burrito Brothers and the Jefferson Airplane before the Rolling Stones come on and stuff like that, you know, and so that was kind of an early influence, I think, was definitely that movie. And as well as like TV shows like The Midnight Special.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's a I just learned recently the guy's name Stan Harris. But he was this guy, the director on the Midnight Special until 1977. And all, you know, I think that the stuff that he did as far as, you know, the camera angles and the directing and stuff that he would choose is like, I'd say that's a big influence on me.
Can a person go and find some of those shows?
Oh, the Midnight Special, there's a ton of those clips on YouTube. They put them out on DVDs and people have put them up on YouTube, and they even say at the end of them, it'll say directed by Stan Harris or somebody else.
Uh-huh.
And he did the Smothers Brothers show, and he also did this show that I really like called The Music Scene that was on for like, you know, a few months in 1969. But I have it on DVD.
Let's play another song.
Okay, yeah.
How about if I click this one forward, we'll get the Scott Law and Tim Bloom?
Yeah, let's do track four.
Excellent.
This is from just recently.
Hey.
school. Sing the Starburst, to the Starburst, the wrong thing. For the sky, rain, and gravel, and the wind just whistling cold. Mercury went 17 below. Judge's gavel, God gave us the dust bowl.
Tim Bloom and Scott Law recorded at the Chico Women's Club at their KZFR benefit. This was a couple of Fridays ago.
It was a Sunday, actually.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Time flies.
But it was just recently. That was such a fun show when we got some really nice footage of that one.
And that was a really nice recording.
Yeah, that was... we could definitely give the credit to Kyle for doing the great mix for that.
Right.
Because
on.
I just pretty much, you know, plugged in and put up a couple little microphones for a little ambience.
Yeah, that was a really nice evening of music.
Yeah, it was.
It really was a nice evening of music. So your program is Banana Grape Stomp.
Right.
And it's on
this Saturday. This Saturday is actually going to have an episode from the Cammies, recorded last year at the Cammy Chico Area Music Awards ceremony, or... award ceremony. And it's a little more local oriented than some of the episodes that have already been on. It's got like Severance Package and Lips of Renegade and Western Divide and Swamp Zen and Solar Estates and did I get them all? Anyway, it's got like you know, Jason Cassidy is on there with Molly talking about some of these local bands. And
nice. And, It's a fun show. Where did the name Banana Grape Stomp come from?
Oh, that's a good question, and I'm glad to answer it because a lot of people wonder that. I wanted to come up with a name that didn't have any other use, you know, that if you look for it on the internet, you know, you weren't going to confuse it with something else. But the place it actually came from when I was first starting to collect live concert recordings, I got this tape of, it's Troopers Hall. It's a famous really early Grateful Dead tape. And it's got this, like, you know, jam on it. And most of the copies of the tape just say jam. But the copy that I got way long ago from this friend of mine, Robert, before I even moved to Chico, somebody called it Banana Grape Stompers. And somehow that just stuck in my mind. And so, I took off the ERs and the theme song to my show, which, was done by Scott Barwick, by the way. Big thanks to Scott for doing that.
Sweet.
I kind of based the riff of that on, the Banana Grape Stompers song from that Grateful Dead tape.
Right on.
Well, but it's basic. But Scott pretty much mostly wrote it all, so it's pretty much all Scott's.
And well, we wanted to give a shout out to Peter Burko, who's producing a music program. This is he originally did a Sierra Center Stage, and that. When was that? That was like in the late 90s?
I think it started around 2002 or so.
Jeez, I can't do this. And hi, Jan.
And we also can't forget about your experience, you know, on Morris Taylor Show.
Oh, yeah. Boy, those were the good old days.
Dan worked on the Morris Taylor Show. I've seen his name in the credits there.
With Joe Hammond was my audio guy.
Yeah, I've seen his name on there, too.
Yeah, I would direct, and Joe would run audio, and we'd go out. That was back when KHSL was at the corner of 4th and Wall, and so we'd go out and get our, and we'd have safety meetings and just have a good old time with Morris. I was listening to one of his CDs the other day, and the man, there's a certain purity about him.
Oh yeah,
that is just undeniable. It's just undeniable. He's awesome. Are you here to do peanut butter and jelly?
I am.
Oh, Jan Bielfeldt is here, and she's going to be coming at you in just a couple of minutes. And then Peter Burko's latest effort is
Music Gone Public.
Music Gone Public.
That's a really, really cool show. Looks great.
It really does look great.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got his first season in the can, and he's going to and he's working on putting things together. Unfortunately, it usually takes 2.5 years to do a season.
Yeah. Well, there is a big difference between Peter's show and my show in that he has a huge budget. I'm definitely like shoestring, you know.
Well, he wouldn't tell you he has a huge budget.
Okay, well, that's maybe
but
that's.
He does, but you're right.
Compared to my show, he has a huge budget.
You have dedicated volunteers.
I've definitely, you know, thanks to Dan and Kyle and Jamie Barris and
Chris Hill.
Few other people.
And the venues, you know, you can't really talk about your show without talking about how the venues let us go in there and do it.
That's true. Everybody's been.
Sometimes they even turn on the lights for
us. Yeah, exactly. Everybody's been totally open to it, and all the artists have been totally cool. There's been a couple times where they haven't been happy with their own performance, you know, so they don't want to, you know, they don't want to be on. There's actually been a couple times where they had disagreements between band members about whether or not to use it, you know. So I'm not trying to cause any strife between the bands, but I totally understand if there's a band that does not, you know, that isn't happy with their performance, I don't want to put it on TV. I want them to be happy with it for sure. So.
Well, Bill does this. It's a labor of love for him.
Yes. And I'm looking for underwriters, you know, by the way. But I do. I've actually got Pullen Cyclery, so big thanks to Pullen Cyclery.
Right on.
Trained you well.
And looking for underwriters.
Yeah.
Right. We've got about a minute and a half.
Yeah, so you probably got to do a little underwriting.
Speaking of underwriting, Butte Views and Beyond is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by the Blue Oak School in Chico, developing public Waldorf education. Blue Oak Charter School provides rigorous academic standards and fully integrated music programs. Blue Oak is committed to nourishing and educating the whole child based on the natural developmental model. For more information or a school tour, call 879-7483 or by visiting blueoakcharterschool.org. And by the second annual Walk MS North State, raising money to help find a cure to multiple sclerosis. The Walk MS North State will be held on Sunday, April 17th in beautiful Bidwell Park with a 1 and 3 mile routes. Yes. Proceeds raised will support cutting-edge MS research and life-changing programs and services for people living with MS. To register and for more information, visit walkms.org or call 855-372-1331. Thank you, MS North State and the Blue Oak Waldorf. Blue Oak School for Sport and Community Radio. Hey, Bill, it's always a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah,
I love working
fun.
With you. And thank you for the support that you're giving our documentary.
Oh, and thank you so much for all your help and everything.
Right on. And hey, it's time to say this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And Jan Bielfeldt's going to sit down here. Do you want me to... Did you do it already?
Well, remember, the clock is fast.
Okay.
There's a light on in the attic. Though the house is dark and shuttered, I can see a flicker and flutter, and I know what it's about. There's a light on in the attic. I can see it from the outside, and I know you're on the inside. Looking out. So many
songs about rainbows and what's on the other side. Rainbows are visions, but only illusions. Rainbows have